Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. Today I'm interviewing Tad Daly, PhD, who is the Writing Fellow with International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, the 1985 Nobel Peace Laureate Organization. He was educated at Knox College, the University of Illinois, the University of Southampton in England, the Rand UCLA Center for Soviet Studies, and the Rand Graduate School for Policy Studies. He spent several years as a member of the International Policy Development at Rand, where many of the nuclear theories of the Cold War era originally were forged. He served as a speechwriter and policy advisor to Congressman Dennis Kucinich, Congresswoman Diane Watson, and the late Senator Alan Cranston. And he himself once ran for the US Congress to represent Mid-City Los Angeles. The LA Weekly said about his campaign, "Tad Daly boasts the most impressive credentials and much the most thoughtful platform of all the 16 candidates in the race. His ideas are as sensible as they are unconventional." Welcome to the program, Tad Daly.
Hello, Dr. Caldicott. It is a joy to speak with you today.
Thank you.
And Helen, if you don't mind, I would like to say something directly to your listeners right here at the outset, if you will indulge me, because it would not be inaccurate for me to say that it's a privilege to talk to someone with your expertise. That is true. It's also a privilege to talk to someone of your stature. That is true. But I really want to say directly to your listeners that it is a privilege to talk to someone who has moved the course of history, who has affected human history. And we're going to spend the next hour talking about the nuclear peril and where things are in the nuclear age these days. But Helen, some good things are happening. A lot of mainstream figures are talking now about the A word, abolition. And I don't think there's any question that is in large measure due to the fact that you have been talking about abolition for 10, 20, 30 years before that. And the American president, I hope we'll get to talk about the speech he made in Prague in April of 2009. That's not a perfect speech, but he did say there that America seeks the peace of a world without nuclear weapons. And I think he would not have said that if you, Helen Caldicott, had not been saying it for the past 10 or 20 or 30 years. And most importantly, if I may, it's 65 years now since the dawn of the nuclear age, and we haven't had a nuclear war. God knows we've come close sometimes, and God knows we still might. But so far, we've dodged the bullet of nuclear annihilation. And Helen Caldicott, I want your listeners to know that in my mind, there's no question that in significant measure, that is due to the work of you.
Oh, Ted, you're very kind. Thank you very much. Tell me then how you got involved in this whole nuclear weapons issue and how on earth you ended up working at Rand, where, as you say in the introduction, many of the theories of the Cold War era were originally forged. I've always seen Rand as a sort of pretty, dangerous, and that's putting it mildly, organization. So how did you get involved in the whole nuclear weapons issue, Tad Daly?
You know, I majored in political science in college, and I've always had an interest in larger affairs, and it just became very clear to me as I studied these things that the largest affair of all is the nuclear affair, the introduction of the nuclear age. There's a lot of headlines and nuclear issues of the hour that we could talk about, but the overriding big picture about nuclear weapons is that they can bring about our own extinction. When the nuclear age began in 1945, it gave the human race, for the first time, the power to bring about its own extinction by its own hands. And that's a remarkable turning point in the history of the human race. And you know the history of the nuclear age. You know we actually came close to a full-scale global thermonuclear war on more than one occasion. The likelihood of that doesn't seem terribly likely today. But if we just look at the likelihood of something today, that doesn't really cut the mustard. If the human race insists on keeping these things around for many more decades to come, surely at some point one of the many scenarios for something going very wrong will indeed come to pass. And it seems to me, I will say this very unambiguously, far from impossible that a century from now, in the first decade of the 21st century, the human race could be extinct. It is far from impossible that we could bring about our own extinction by our own hands, unless we get serious about getting rid of these things now.
Well,
that,
you've just...
like a pretty worthwhile cause to devote oneself to.
A tad, Daly, you've just written a book called Apocalypse Never, published by Rutgers University Press. It was published in May, and the subtitle is Forging the Path to a Nuclear Weapon-Free World. Now, you say that the human race, you just said, is keeping these weapons around, but I don't think it's the human race. I think it's a very, very, very small group of men who are addicted to these weapons because they're big, they produce the most incredible explosion. And I do remember interviewing Ted Taylor, who developed the suitcase hydrogen bomb. And as he described the explosions that these weapons produce, he got very excited. And I said, Ted, you're addicted to these explosions. And he said, quite frankly, yes, I am. Yet he was a man who was deeply concerned about the threat of nuclear war and the sentiments you've just been talking about. So do you want to talk about that small group of men? And I have to say, it is true I've been talking about abolition of nuclear weapons for probably 40 years, but it's not until the nuclear hawks like Kissinger, Perry, Sam Nunn, and others have suddenly said, oh, yes, that's a good idea. Why did it take these men to talk about it before the media wakes up and says, oh, my God, maybe it's a good idea? I don't understand this, Tad.
Well, I cannot disagree with what you said. You are right that there is sort of indeed, with a small group of men, and they are mostly men, the nuclear theorists, who really, I think your word addicted is quite right. I guess I would put it this way. Throughout human history, up until 1945, it seemed relatively self-evident that the more firepower one had on behalf of one state, the more secure one would be on behalf of one state. But I think that really all changed in the nuclear age, because once one country, you know this truth very well, Dr. Caldicott, once one country let the genie out of the bottle, it became inevitable that others would seek to get their hands on the genie themselves.
I mean, in the books I wrote a book called Missile Envy in 1984, and used the language of the nuclear theorists from Rand, and I used to pass Rand, which was a sort of a pinkish building on the way down to Santa Monica, quite frequently, and I just used to think that's where the evil people reside, and they're still around. I think the problem is that most people, the ordinary people who, you know, have their jobs and losing their houses and bringing up their children and sending the kids to college and all of that stuff, have no real understanding or idea of what these men have been saying, what they've been planning, and what the psyches of these men consist of. Would you like to extrapolate a little bit on that, Tad Daly?
Well, I think that's exactly right, but it is especially right in the past, let's say two decades. you and I are old enough. I feel very young and healthy and vigorous, but I've got gray hair. And so I remember this thing called the Cold War. But, of course, the general public for that 45-year period between 1945 and 1990 did, in fact, have a vague awareness that the world was in mortal peril from the nuclear arms race between the United States and the Soviet Union and the possibility that a conflict between the U.S. and the USSR would descend into a shooting war, and that would descend downward into a nuclear war. But then the Cold War ended a good two decades ago now. And for most of the general public, that means that the nuclear peril went away as well. There just was sort of an intuitive sense that, well, we lived with this threat of a global thermonuclear war between Moscow and Washington for 4.5 decades, and now that is gone. But you and I know that, A, the arsenals are still there. 23,000 nuclear warheads still exist on the planet. And, in fact, the threat is still there, too.
Talking about first strike nuclear war, I want you to walk us through a scenario by which this could happen, that, the Chinese have hacked into the early warning system in the Pentagon, which they are currently doing now and then, and also brilliant young men can also hack into this system. What would be the sort of sequence of events by which, you know, Obama would be woken up, you know, and how would it all proceed?
There's many ways. If I may, let me give two examples, if I may. I'd like to tell your listeners that virtually all of them are aware that in 1962, something called the Cuban Missile Crisis happened, and that brought the world very close to the brink of a full-scale global thermonuclear war, only 17 years into the nuclear age. But I bet hardly any of our listeners today know that almost the same thing happened in 1983, a nuclear war coming about, not by virtue of an accidental launch, but by, again, what I call crisis mismanagement, because of misunderstanding and misinformation. This is something Dr. Caldicott called the Abel Archer crisis. It took place in the fall of 1983, and here's what happened. NATO was conducting war. Tensions were pretty high in 1983, I should say, between the United States and the Soviet Union. Ronald Reagan was our president. He was engaging in a lot of belligerent rhetoric. He was ramping up both American nuclear arsenal and American military spending. And there was, I think it's fair to say, the Cold War was at a pretty intense point. And so, it is the fall of 1983, and NATO is engaging in war games in Western Europe, which they did every fall. But because of the political winds of the hour, because of some mistaken intelligence, because of the war games taking place, apparently, in the Kremlin, for about 72 hours, the leadership of the Politburo concluded that it wasn't war games, concluded that the United States and NATO was, in fact, planning to invade Eastern Europe and to launch a nuclear first strike upon the USSR. We weren't. It was just war games. Tensions were high, but that didn't mean we were actually planning to attack them. But for 72 hours is my understanding of what happened. They thought we were going to launch a nuclear first strike upon them, and consequently, they very seriously contemplated launching their own nuclear first strike first. And you know what saved us? We happened to have a spy. It was the British, actually. The British had a well-placed spy who had some kind of an ear into the high councils of the Soviet Central Committee and the Politburo, and this spy found out that the Soviet leadership did think we were about to launch a nuclear first strike, and consequently were thinking about launching their own nuclear first strike. And he sent a panicky message back to London, and he said, stop the war games, stop the war games. And as soon as that message went in, they did. But what a roll of the dice that is. We were saved, again, from a full-scale global thermonuclear war, totally by luck, totally by a roll of the dice, totally by the most capricious whim of the gods. And anyone who understands anything about the engines of human history knows
Yes, well, the Pentagon love conducting war games. They've just had one in Korea, which is a very big hotspot, really annoying the North Koreans. And I know that they play virtual war games in the Pentagon all day. And one of the classic ones they play is if North Korea invades South Korea, and it always ends up in a nuclear holocaust. So these, I mean, if you psychoanalyze these fellows, you'd have to say they were mad. Indulging in war games for mutually assured destruction, they are mad. Now, give us your third scenario whereby a nuclear war could start, Tad Daly.
Almost the most unknown one of all. It is what I call simply, it's not a very sexy name, conscious intentional use. I'm not talking about a crisis where there's a moment of panic and lots of uncertainty and lots of fear and lots of misinformation. I'm talking about the leadership of some state, in a cold, sober, conscious manner, deciding in some geopolitical beef that that country's national interest will be served by launching a nuclear first strike. And one might say, oh, well, that, how could any leader possibly conclude such a thing? Well, it is 65 years ago, this year, that Hiroshima and Nagasaki happened. That's the only episode, obviously, that we have of an actual nuclear attack in human history so far. And that's really the scenario that this was. Hiroshima and Nagasaki certainly weren't non-state actors like a nuclear terror attack. It wasn't an accident, was it? Nor was it a moment of panic. Harry Truman and the advisors around him, like James Conant and Vannevar Bush and Henry Stimson, they weren't in a moment of panic. They weren't filled with uncertainty. They weren't afraid that the Japanese were about to launch a nuclear first strike upon us, of course. They sat down and made a cold, rational decision that American interests would be served by launching a nuclear attack. And in fact, every American administration since then has constructed what they call nuclear weapons employment doctrines. Deployment is putting the weapons out there. Employment is actually using them. Mm-hmm. And every administration has a very elaborate set of nuclear weapon employment doctrines. The nuts, as we said earlier, are the people who are constructing these. And Helen, that is even true of Barack Obama. And, you know, I'll say candidly, I like Barack Obama better than I liked George W. Bush and better than I liked Ronald Reagan on many things, including this thing. But even Barack Obama, who gave a speech in Prague in April of 2009 that said America seeks the peace and security of a world without nuclear weapons. And again, at the very outset, I gave you some of the credit for that, and I mean that very genuinely. But even Barack Obama, who utters a sentence like that, still a year later in April of 2010, issued something called the American Nuclear Posture Review, and it has several scenarios where the United States might choose to launch, in a cold, sober, rational manner, a nuclear first strike.
Well, okay, the Nuclear Posture Review is written and produced every 5 years by people in the Pentagon, handed to the president as one piece. I think it's got about 246 pages in it. State then, here we have a president who's overtly called for abolition of nuclear weapons, who understands, I think, in his bone marrow what it really means, yet he is under the influence and, may I say, power of these nameless, faceless people in the Pentagon who've written this document. Now, the document is scary, Nuclear Posture Review, so can you just give us 4 or 5 points out of that document, Tad Daly, that indicates how incredibly dangerous it is?
Sure. I think very few Americans are aware that this Nuclear Posture Review even exists. It was a good thing in some levels, in some ways. I can't avoid saying that it was clearly an improvement over the Nuclear Posture Review of George W. Bush, five and 10 years earlier. This one was unclassified, and that was a good thing. This one said that there's not going to be any American nuclear testing. That was a good thing. This one said, unlike the Bush administration, that America would not build any new nuclear weapons, although that's very elusive because going in and modernizing a nuclear weapon, to me, sounds...
They're building new nuclear weapons.
I think that's true. Yes. But there's several things that are just utterly missing in the nuclear posture review. For one thing, there's no de-alerting. We talked about this thing called launch on warning and keeping these things both in submarines and on bombers and in land-based missiles, keeping them on air trigger alert so they can be launched within minutes. As Bruce Blair, a former nuclear missileer, likes to say, they ain't called Minutemen for nothing. They can be launched within minutes.
And I like that.
I thought for sure the Obama administration would be able to come up with some kind of doctrine of nuclear security that said we can live without having to have these things on air trigger alert. But no, that was conspicuous by its absence in the nuclear posture review. Something else that was conspicuous in the nuclear posture review, and it's something that people like you and me and other nuclear disarmament advocates have really worked and really pushed on over the years, is a policy of no first use, is stating that we will never use these things first. Ultimately, you and I and others hope to get rid of every last one on planet Earth. But before that happens, I think it's a very reasonable request to say to the United States government, at least Washington, say that you will never use these things except in response to someone else using these things against us.
But
you will only use them
in retaliation. Even then, Tad Daly, that's a crazy posture in itself. You apparently have worked out a plan to move towards and produce abolition of nuclear weapons. Would you like to outline it in very clear detail so that we all understand how we go about this?
Well, thank you, Dr. Caldicott. I'm not sure that I'd call it a plan, really, but I do in my book, and I spent 5 years writing this book, and it just came out in May, and it's called Apocalypse Never. And to answer your question, I guess I'd like to say that what I try to do in the book is not only lay out four scenarios where I think detonations might actually come about, but also try to envision how we might actually get from here to abolition. Try to envision some plausible future histories by which abolition might come about, and try to envision what I call the architecture of a nuclear weapon-free world. Really try to grapple with what kinds of mechanisms of global governance we will have to invent, both to make and to keep a nuclear weapon-free world. And so, yes, well, let me talk a little bit about some of those, because I think this is something, if I may, that Obama hasn't said a word about. It's great for Obama to go to Prague and say, I'm for a nuclear weapon-free world, but they haven't begun to think about what a nuclear weapon-free world might actually look like. And we're going to have to create mechanisms of verification, and we're going to have to create mechanisms of enforcement. And there's a lot of kind of detailed stuff in the book. It's not so much Tad Daly's plan. It's saying these are the kind of challenges that we're going to have to grapple with. But let me get one very big one out on the table right now. It is inspection, the notion of inspection. That is what took place in Iraq between 1991 and 2003. And it's what I think is going to have to happen universally in a nuclear weapon-free world. We make demands on countries like Iraq before we invaded them in 2003. We make demands today on countries like Iran and North Korea that they need to open themselves up to intrusive inspections. And Helen, one of the biggest ideas, if I may, in my book and one of the biggest components of my plan is the simple proposition that in a post-abolition world, in a nuclear weapon-free world, all countries are going to have to open themselves up to something like that. All countries are going to have to be willing to subject themselves to intrusive inspections.
The first one needs to be the United States, because it is the most secretive, and Israel, and I guess you'd include Russia, but America won't let anyone near its nuclear weapons, even its own citizens, let alone United Nations inspectors. And I have to say, sitting from where I am in a small fishing village in Australia at the moment, the hypocrisy of the United States really just takes my breath away. Like, we're the only ones who can blow up the world, and hey, you're not allowed to even build one. And so the United States is actually the example to the whole world, and most of the governments of the world are run by men. And I think many have a case of missile envy. And to enter the portal of the nuclear club makes you ultimately powerful. All you need is one nuclear weapon to scare the bejesus out of everyone. So why shouldn't other people have nuclear weapons? And you see, these issues, fundamental moral and psychological principles, are not even addressed in the Nuclear Posture Review because it's written by the madmen in the Pentagon. And you know, there's that, I'm thinking as you talk, the show The Mad Men. Well, they're not really mad compared to the real men who are mad. And I say that advisedly and carefully.
Thank you, Doctor. Yeah. That is so important. And, you know, the Nuclear Posture Review is long and detailed, but you are absolutely right. There is one word that doesn't appear anywhere in its pages, and that word is, as you said, hypocrisy.
Yeah.
Hypocrisy. And I'm pleased to say that the opening chapter of my book is called The Essence of the Problem, America's Nuclear Hypocrisy.
Excellent.
Because if ever we're going to convince the rest of the world, the 190 states today that don't have nuclear weapons, if ever we're going to convince them to choose permanently to abjure the nuclear course, we're going to have to directly confront the nuclear double standard. And you're absolutely right that the madmen, the nuts, they just absolutely refuse to acknowledge that there is anything like a double standard. And they absolutely refuse to acknowledge that, as you say, and I think it's so important, Ellen, the way you talk about the psychological component of this, the missile envy. Is that a term that you coined? I think it is.
Yeah, I did, actually.
I thought so, yes.
During one of my lectures.
It's yet another of your many contributions to the debate and the movement. It really is, because the nuts in the United States just don't understand that there must be something like missile envy out there. And especially, let me make this point, especially given that the United States, my country, has such overwhelming conventional military dominance over any other conceivable actor. So here's the position of the United States today. Here's what the United States is essentially saying to the rest of the world. We have this overwhelmingly powerful conventional military force. Your listeners need to know the United States spends more on its military today than all the other countries in the world put together. An astonishing fact, probably utterly unprecedented in all of human history.
If I may interrupt, the United States has no enemies at the moment. No national enemies. None.
The Nuclear Posture Review essentially says, even though we have this overwhelmingly powerful conventional military power, we still cannot guarantee our own national security without relying on a nuclear arsenal, without relying on a nuclear deterrent, without relying on the threat of mutually assured destruction. So how credible can that possibly be? How can a small country like Syria or Egypt or Iran or North Korea, how can they possibly be expected to protect their own national security with their laughably smaller conventional military power if we say, with our enormous conventional military power, we still need to rely on nuclear weapons? The message that says is that if the strong need to rely on nuclear weapons, then the weak are going to have to seek nuclear weapons of their own.
Well, and to analyze it more deeply then, as America has no state enemies, there might be a few people who want to blow up something or other, they call them terrorists, but has no state enemies, why does it need all this talk about national security and a nuclear weapons security that they talk about. In fact, if you psychoanalyze the situation, it's a case of schizophrenia. There's a split between reality, what is really real in the world, and perception. And so these people are going along on a fantasy, like I suppose we were when we were troglodytes living in caves, that, you know, there were saber-toothed tigers out there and there were marauding tribes and we have to protect our women in the caves breastfeeding the children, sort of primitive midbrain stuff, when the reality is that no one could ever invade America, and it has no state enemies. So it is a fantasy, an absolute fantasy that's perpetuated by the societal schizophrenic attitude.
Well, you know, Helen Caldicott, there are many people in Washington, where I live and work, who, if they were in this call right now, they would say, no, that's not right.
Yeah.
I don't agree with that, Helen Caldicott. They would say America does have some real enemies and some real threats, and they would probably name Iran and North Korea.
Ridiculous.
Iran and North Korea are the boogeymen du jour, we might say.
Got to have boogeymen.
Well, you got to have boogeymen, yes. And these people would say, well, North Korea has been a very irresponsible international actor, and they've acquired a nuclear arsenal, and they engage in belligerent rhetoric, and their leader, Kim Jong-il, is clearly unstable and volatile and unpredictable. And when it comes to Iran, their leader has engaged in, and I would agree with them on this, has engaged in deplorable rhetoric, specifically about Israel, when he denies the existence of the Holocaust, when he says, although this is probably something of a mistranslation, but he still came close to saying Israel should be, quote, wiped off the map. And so these people in Washington hear that kind of rhetoric, and they say, so therefore, Iran and North Korea are threats to us, and we can't permit them to have nuclear weapons. Here's what I would like to say in response to that, Dr. Caldicott. I don't want Iran and North Korea to have nuclear arsenals either. And many smart people are really trying to figure out a way to forestall that eventuality. And I'm not really smart enough to figure out exactly the best way to forestall that eventuality. My book, Apocalypse Never, is not about two states not having nuclear weapons. It's about all states not having nuclear weapons. But I do want to say this, and this is a very crucial point, and it is, in fact, the central point of one of my 12 chapters in the book. Even irrational leaders can head states with rational national interests. And I think it is unambiguously clear that Iran and North Korea, they haven't been saints. I don't think they're perfect states and perfect leaders, but they themselves have felt threatened by the outside world in recent years. God knows they were threatened during the Bush administration, when the Bush administration named three states as members of an axis of evil and announced a doctrine of preemption and then pulled the trigger on the preemption on one of those three, Iraq. And I think the rational, if I will say this very forthrightly, if I were a North Korean defense planner, if I were an Iranian defense planner, I would be saying our best hope for making sure the United States doesn't invade us is to acquire a nuclear arsenal.
Yeah,
you're right.
Dr.
Caldicott, our best strategy for persuading them to abjure the nuclear course is going to be to not threaten these states, to not make them feel like they need a nuclear deterrent to protect themselves from us.
Mm-hmm. It's such primitive thinking, though, isn't it? Really, it's just pure tribalism. The whole thing,
Excellent word, yes.
And I think
primitive tribalism.
Yeah, as a physician, you see, I'm always interested in finding the cause of a disease, that what we call etiology. Otherwise, we can't cure it. We have no hope of curing it. We don't know the cause of many cancers, for instance. We do know the cause of polio, and we've helped to eliminate it in the developed world anyway. But the cause of the most dangerous pathology now on the planet is this tribalism. I'm reading a very interesting book at the moment called The Male Brain, which is absolutely doused and seeped in testosterone and vasopressin, which stimulate aggression, anger, and physical responses to threats. So as I read more and more of it, I think, oh my God, I think it's so intrinsic in the male, both humans and animals, that I'm not sure that we can do anything about it. But I think I want to write a book about it, so that at least the discussion is out in the open, because there's a lot of recent work done now on hormone receptors in the brain and the influence upon behavior. And I think if the more people that understand this, the more we can maybe get a handle on it. Probably too late, but I think it's worth looking at.
Yeah, you know, boy, may I tell your listeners that my book has been out since May, and I've done about, oh, I don't know, 15 or 20 radio interviews, but very few like this, Dr. Caldicott. I mean, it's so important that you talk about the psychological underpinning and the sort of deep-seated elements of human nature that really seem to drive the nuclear arms race and the nuclear peril and the threat of nuclear annihilation. And I guess what I would say in response to what you just said is, if that is the case, that this tribalism, this primitivism, is just so inherent in human nature, that makes it all the more imperative that we've got to find a way to construct some kind of doctrine of national security and doctrine or structure, I should say, of world order that doesn't rely on weapons that, as we said to each other an hour ago, carries inherent within them the possibility of bringing about our own demise by our own hand. And you know, Helen, if I may, I'd like to say something else about that, especially given what you've just said about the essence of human nature. And if I may, this is the first time I've mentioned discussed this in a radio interview, but in my closing chapter in the book, I talk about something that very few people in the nuclear policy wonk realm ever talk about, and it's extraterrestrial intelligence and the possibility that we live in a galaxy, in a universe that is teeming with other life and indeed with other sentient life, but the other possibility is that it's not. The other possibility is that we are alone. It is far from inconceivable that the emergence of life and then the development of that life, which happened on this planet about 3.5 billion years ago, and then over a long period of time, the development of that life into creatures with the kind of brains that we have, it is quite possible, certainly not certain, but certainly not impossible, that that is such a unique confluence of events that it is, in fact, utterly unique in all the 13.7 billion year history of the universe. And think about the implications of that. Think about the stake. If this is, in fact, the only place in all of space and time where sentient life, for all its flaws, has emerged, how arrogant of us to say at this one tiny window of time, just the 65 years since 1945, that we hold this power to eradicate that life, and we're not really making any effort to come up with some better ideas and to eliminate, at least by this vehicle, the power to bring about our own demise by our own hands. To me, there can be no higher moral calling, no higher ethical calling, indeed, for any person of spirit and faith, no more powerful obligation that we have to the Creator than to do what we can to make sure that we preserve the creation.
Or even if there's a person of no spirituality or faith, which is me, I'm an agnostic, as a physician, deeply within my soul, I worship the life process and always have. And I was quite a close friend of Carl Sagan, and I once asked him, the great astronomer, Carl, do you think there is any other life in the universe? And he paused for quite a while. And then he said to me, no, I don't think so. And I said, why? And he said, because if any species had reached the stage of development that we've reached, they would have annihilated themselves.
That is a clear possibility, isn't it? It is far from impossible that other sentient races have emerged since the Big Bang, and have brought about their own demise by their own hands.
Possibly.
And if that's the case, that makes the stakes even bigger for us, because by God, Helen, let us be the first.
Yeah.
Let us be the first, then, if what Carl Sagan hypothesized there is true, let us be the first to say that our brains are big enough, our brains are good enough, so that our social and political imagination can keep up with and keep pace with our scientific and technological prowess.
Well, then, Tad Daly, doesn't that lead us back to, I think, the very fundamental essence of humans? We've got to stop killing each other, because the nuclear weapons have evolved out of that primitive instinct to kill. You see it happening now in African states, young men armed with weapons and the like. I think we've got to really get to the nub of this, and that we have to understand we have to stop killing.
Well, you know, Helen, I might put this slightly differently. My understanding of the human animal and the human heritage is it's not so much an instinct to kill as it is an instinct, and you put it this way earlier, to defend one's own tribe.
Mm-hmm.
When human beings go out and kill other human beings, it's because they very deeply and intuitively feel that they are defending their tribe against the aggression and assault and threat from another tribe. I think, you know, God, even the Nazi soldiers, I think, I mean, most people seem to think that that was about the most brutal regime that has ever emerged in human history in Germany between 1933 and 1945. But the German soldiers, and even the SS soldiers, I think they themselves surely had in their head the notion, much of it was put there in a polluted fashion by Adolf Hitler, but they had the notion that they were defending their tribe, the tribe of the Aryan people, against the assault from other tribes. And again, you've mentioned primitive tribalism in this conversation several times, and I think that really gets to the heart of it. Especially, if I may, Helen Caldicott, because that, to me, really calls upon the solution. And the solution is a far larger one than just the abolition of nuclear weapons, the cause to which you and I and others really devote most of our efforts. It is, if I may, the idea that the ultimate solution to this challenge is the idea that there is only one tribe.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that there is only one human race.
Yeah.
The idea that our deepest identity and our deepest loyalty has to be not to the country where we happen to have been born, but to the human community in which we happen to have been born, and to the planet of which we are a part. And if I may, on this point, I love the name of your show, If You Love This Planet. It's not If You Love Your Tribe. It's If You Love This Planet. And inherent in the name of your show, God bless you, Helen Caldicott, is the idea that the planet and the whole of the human species, and indeed the whole of the circle of life, is the thing to which our deepest loyalty and identity must attach.
Well, on that fantastic note, we end this conversation, Tad Daly, and I thank you so much for your insights. I think it's been absolutely fascinating, and I hope it stimulates much thought within both you and I and our listeners.
Thank you very much, Dr. Caldicott. Again, it is a privilege to speak with someone who is not only full of stature and experience, but indeed has affected the course of human history.
Thank you, Ted.
You know, Helen, could I just quickly tell your listeners that we have a wonderful website for the book.
Yes, please.
We've had
yes.
a good conversation
yep.
about the topic here.
Very important.
And the book. The book is called Apocalypse Never, and it is about both the vision of a nuclear weapon-free world, but I think it is also about this larger ethic of human unity and human destiny that we've talked about in this conversation. And if people will simply go to apocalypsenever.org, apocalypsenever.org, there's all kinds of info and all kinds of links about the topic, about the author, about the book, and about the vision of peace and hope.
Okay. Thank you very much, Tad. I hope we see each other around the traps quite soon.
Indeed, Helen. Thank you very much.
Today on If You Love This Planet, I've been interviewing Dr. Tad Daly, who is the writing fellow with International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. He has just written a book called Apocalypse Never, published by Rutgers University Press in May this year. My guest today on If You Love This Planet is Senator Scott Ludlam. Senator Ludlam was elected in November 2007 as an Australian Greens Senator for Western Australia. He is currently one of five Australian Greens Senators who have established a track record of positive negotiations with all parties in the Parliament. He is a spokesperson for communications, housing, human heritage, legal affairs, local government, mining, nuclear issues, public transport, and sustainable cities. Scott Ludlam, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Let's go on to the railway line built by Halliburton, which was run by our friend Dick Cheney, that bisects Australia from Adelaide to Darwin. And let's talk about Tennant Creek and Muckaty Station, where they want to bury high-level radioactive waste, and what the future could mean for that, Scott, and what it means for the local Aboriginal population.
Well, this is a real very heated campaign for us at the moment. So if you can imagine what's happened in the US with the Yucca Mountain proposal on a, you know, on a much smaller scale, very, very similar story here in Australia, in that you had the federal government proposing to just dump this material in what looked to them like a very remote location, you know, a long way from the capital, a long way from where this material is being produced. We don't have commercial nuclear power stations here in Australia. We have had a research reactor with 10 megawatts. The one that's built now is 20. So on a vastly smaller scale, but perversely enough, an identical political dynamic that you had in the instance of the US, you had the state of Nevada very strongly opposing the siting, and here we've got the Northern Territory opposing the siting, local Aboriginal tribal communities opposing it. They've taken legal action here in the federal court, and the environment and the anti-nuclear movement around the country standing up very strongly to prevent that from happening. Now, it's not too dissimilar from campaigns that have been waged around the world, where you have to ask the industry, if this material is so safe, why should it not remain close to the point of production, above ground where it can be monitored and repackaged? And if it's not safe, then how dare you dump it in the backyard of people who had no role at all in its production and just simply attempt to bulldoze right over the top of them and build that facility? We think that there's room for a deep breath and for a step back to take a look at what should be done with this material. And the first thing that should be done, I think, is that we need to take a good solid look at why we're producing it in the first place and whether we need to be producing it, how we can wind back its production. But for the legacy material that does exist, it needs to be looked after close to the point of production and certainly not put onto the back of a truck and taken to a sheet station, to a cattle station, and then dumped.
And, I think the original Liberal government, which is our Conservative government, bribed two tribal elders to the tune of a promise of $12 million if they went along with this radioactive waste dump. But the majority of people who own that land, Aboriginal people, are deeply opposed to it. And also, isn't it atop an aquifer? It's a very high rainfall area there, Senator Ludlam?
Yeah, we tried to visit it late last year, and the road was still flooded across. And as I said before, it's also an area of quite high seismic activity. They do have earthquakes out there semi-regularly. It's one of the hot spots. The issue really, which is attendant on the waste dump campaign and for development activity right across Australia, is that these are communities that are politically marginalised. They suffer some of the worst poverty, not just in Australia, but in the region, really devastating conditions that shorten people's lifespans. And institutional support has either never been there or it's been withdrawn. So when the government comes along and says, we'll give you $12 million if you host this facility, people pay attention. And I for one, don't blame a particular community for taking it and saying, well, we're suffering such neglect here. If this stuff is as safe as you say it is, then we'll take it and we will have that. The problem, of course, is that not everybody was consulted, and there is, as you say, there's absolutely no community consent amongst the broader population out there. And really, $12 million over a period of 300 years, only $40,000 a year, there won't be any employment. There'll be two security guards stationed out there. And what they're not telling them is that that 300 years is only the half-life, 10 half-lives of the low-level material, after which you could begin to take your eyes off it and treat it as uncontaminated. What they haven't told them is what they intend to do with the very, very long-lived lethal material, which is the spent fuel from the reactor, which would need to be isolated for a period of tens or hundreds of thousands of years.
Well, the other thing that deeply worries me, Senator Ludlam, is I think there's a possibility that we could be importing some of America's high-level radioactive waste in the future through the Global Nuclear Energy Partnership that was drawn up by the previous Liberal government, not vetoed by the new government, and it may be possible that a deal was done to import America's radioactive waste into our kind of empty country. What do you think of that?
Look, I think if there'd been a deal done with the United States, we'd know about it already.
I guess I'm
more concerned about that. The US has this huge political fight on at the moment about what to do with 60 years of this legacy waste that the industry's always promised they had an idea and they had a solution, and of course it's just not true.
Yeah.
What we did have here in Australia 10 years or so ago was a proposal for a multinational for-profit radioactive waste dump, which would import waste not necessarily from the US in the first instance, but from Southeast Asian states and countries around the world, which are potentially, you know, for example, Taiwan and places which are smaller, for which there is absolutely no long or medium-term plan at all for dealing with that high-level material. Our fear, of course, as relates to the US, is once we get a waste dump started up in Australia, the rest of the planet is going to see that and go, well, they have one. It's a much simpler process to relicense that and expand its mandate than to start a new site somewhere else. That's where the railway line that you mentioned at the outset comes in, is that we have had this line now cut through central Australia from Port Augusta in the south to Darwin Port in the north, which could very easily be used to bring material in from anywhere in the world. So at the moment we're focused on the local impact of bringing long-lived radioactive materials to that site from southern Australia. But of course we have to have our eye on the fact that once these projects are in place, it'll be formidably difficult to prevent their mandate from being expanded.
So one last question, Senator Ludlam. I know you're busy and need to go. When the Greens finally have the real balance of power in the Senate, what hope do you have of stopping this whole process, stopping uranium mining in Australia and stopping this radioactive waste dump in the Northern Territory on Aboriginal tribal land? What hope do you have?
I've got high hopes, but not necessarily in the parliamentary process. We'll do our bit, and we've got some allies in there, and we'll do everything that we can in Parliament. But I think ultimately this campaign, as many, will be won or lost in public opinion. And the basic injustice of dumping the nation's most toxic radioactive waste on a community that doesn't want it. The problem that we have in the Parliament is simply one of raw numbers. Even next year, after July, there'll be 9 of us, but that's in a chamber of 76. And when the major parties collude to do these kind of things, there's not a great deal we can do about it.
Yes.
So we'll continue to work with the Aboriginal people of the area, with the campaigners from around the country, and we'll do our bit, and we'll try and drive the agenda in the Parliament and do everything that we can to prevent it from happening. But ultimately, these campaigns won or lost on the strength of the people who are on the front line.
Always. Senator Ludlam, do you have a website that people could go to from overseas to learn more about the situation in Australia from a nuclear perspective?
Yeah, look, there are a couple. I think to begin with, if you just take a look at the Australian Greens website, you can see all our material there on the waste dump campaign, and that'll give you a start. And I will just give you that address. So if you just go to Greens MP, so greensmps.org.au, that'll give you a start. But then if people also want to Google the name Muckaty, M-U-C-K-A-T-Y, Google Muckety, you'll find a whole host of resources and campaign news there on the Waste Done campaign.
Yes, and I think it's important for people in the United States whose political system is in such turmoil now to know that it is possible to get a third party up and running, and a Green Party. I know that Ralph Nader tried to form one, but maybe now's the time to seriously start thinking about a new party in the United States, and you could communicate with Senator Ludlam to see maybe how it could be done.
Well, I think in the US, probably electoral reform is the key, because there's a system, and all systems are archaic to a degree.
Yeah.
But in the US, which pioneered this form of electoral representation, the system still has aspects that are very strongly stuck in the 17th and 18th century. What you'll notice from multi-party systems around the world is that a system of proportional representation and particularly preferential voting is really, really important, so that progressive candidates don't split the vote, as allegedly happened with the Nader Gore campaign two elections ago, and happened to the conservative side of politics when Ross Perot made his run. The electoral system, I think, there is actually serving the American people really quite poorly. So some campaign there around electoral reform, I think, is probably overdue.
Yes, that's wonderful. Well, thank you very much for this very informative interview, Senator Ludlam, and I wish you luck in your ongoing activities.
Lovely. Thanks, Eva. Nice to talk to you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. My guest today on If You Love This Planet was Australian Green Senator for Western Australia, Senator Scott Ludlam. Thank you for listening. I think it's been a fascinating conversation as ever. If you want to learn more about If You Love This Planet, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org. If you would like to contribute to continuing this program and forwarding the message, there is a page where you can contribute. And we will be talking with you again next week.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.